Welcome to the Evolution Show. I'm Johan Landgren. Today, we're back with the super exciting eco-warrior, environmental advisor, and changemaker, Pella Thiel, to talk about the exciting work she's doing for an ecocide law, as well as other legal rights for nature. I hope you like the content, and if you want to support the show, we really appreciate a thumbs up, and consider subscribing. As always, stay ahead of the curve and stay electric. This is the Evolution Show. Welcome back to the Evolution Show, Pella Thiel.
Thank you, Johan.
You were also here in the previous episode when we talked about legal rights for nature and your background in the transition movement, but you are also a chairperson of the End Ecocide Sweden that works to protect nature with legal rights similar to ones people and companies have. And you have received the prestigious award of Environmental Hero of the Year by the World Wildlife Foundation, and you got the prize from the king himself in Sweden. Yeah, so I encourage people to check out the previous episode to learn more about you and your work. But today we're digging deeper into ecocide law. So my first question, as I understand it right now, you're consulting legal experts and guardians of nature, such as yourself, to build a legal framework that can work in Sweden and other countries to protect entities in nature, such as rivers, forests, and mountains, and so on. Can you tell us how you do this and what you want to achieve?
Yeah, so I think first I need to unpack a bit because ecocide law and rights of nature are related but different. And I think it's worth spending some time on how that is. So ecocide law is a very specific piece of legislation where ecocide or mass damage and destruction of nature can be an international crime in the same context as the other crimes of concern to the whole international community, like crimes against humanity and genocide within the International Criminal Court in The Hague. So that's what I spend most of my time on now because of all the momentum created around that idea at the moment. But I'm also very involved in rights of nature, which is a much both broader and deeper transformational idea where we can acknowledge that not just humans have an intrinsic value and rights of existence and health, but actually all living systems have that right, and that right can also be acknowledged and enshrined in law in a very practical way. And that is kind of actually a paradigm shift which has which would have repercussions in everything we do. So yeah, those fields are what I'm working on. And I think ecocide law is interesting as a stepping stone towards rights of nature, because you could have ecocide as a crime within an anthropocentric framework. So most of our systems in this society, they are totally anthropocentric. And you could say that we have to have ecocide criminalized because humans need living systems. But if we would also acknowledge that nature has a right to exist, then you would also have ecocide as a crime to protect that right of existence. So it's kind of works on both those levels. And so I like to think of myself as a transformational change agent. So I'm always looking at, so what ideas are possible to work with that both can be understood by the system we are in today, but also lead to and can work in a system, in a different system that I think we need to move towards.
For people who just, you know, tune in here and listen to this, and they might wonder, like, okay, legal rights for a river, it sounds a bit weird. How can it work in practice? But I understand it actually doesn't have to be very complicated. I mean, today we have legal protection for example, infants and so on. It could be similarly designed. So perhaps you can explain how this could work.
Yeah. So, as you said, one of the first problems that arises in people's head is like, oh, but the river can't speak. So how do we know what it wants? How do we know what rights it has? There's always humans who understand and who say what rights a river can have. And that's true, of course. But as you say, that's not exclusive for rivers. But we protect a lot of entities that hasn't the right or the possibility to communicate like most humans have, like babies, for example, or some disabled people, or even entities like corporations who have legal rights. But those rights have to be interpreted by humans. And this is something that the legal system doesn't have any problems with at all. And that can work in the same way for a river, for example. So we can have a representative that speaks for the river. And it's also not really complicated to understand what the river wants to be healthy. I mean, we can, we have a lot of ideas on how to measure the health of a river through science. We do that all the time. So, it sounds weird, but it isn't.
No, and perhaps that could be a good, bridge to some examples. There are in New Zealand, I know there is a river, right, that is protected. So perhaps you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So there are many cases actually around, especially rivers, interestingly. Now, when I first started to think about rights of nature, which is more or less 8 years ago or something, I thought, wow, this idea is profound. It's powerful. It's very important. And I can spend my life working on it. And I won't ever see a difference, because it's so foreign to our way of thinking. And boy, was I wrong. It has just exploded the last years. And one of the most talked about examples is the Whanganui River in New Zealand. So one of the largest rivers of New Zealand, and perceived by the Maori people in New Zealand, the indigenous people, as a part of who they are. So they have this saying, for example, I am the river is me. And for an ecologist like me, that is kind of a physical reality also. I mean, my body is 2/3 water. So if I live by a river, I'm going to drink the water from that river, and the river is going to be me. And this is an understanding that I think all indigenous peoples share, that we are a part of a living system. So the ideas of rights of nature are informed by and inspired by indigenous worldviews. And in New Zealand, this was a very long legal case, more than 100 years, when the Maori went to the crown in New Zealand, the British crowns that colonized New Zealand. And they went there and said, you know, you are polluting this river, and you're destroying it, and you're damming it, and you're putting sewage in it. And, you know, that means that you are polluting us and violating us, because we are part of this river. And they went to court like again and again and again. And it's really interesting. I've read the court cases, and it's really profound to hear them, you know, their representatives saying, I feel so embarrassed standing here again in front of this court just saying that you are violating us as a people. Please stop doing that. You have to take care of the river. So this was a very difficult situation and a difficult conflict that was quite elegantly resolved in starting from, I think, 2010 or so, when some people in New Zealand had heard or were informed by an American law professor, Christopher Stone, which wrote a piece in the 70s called Should Trees Have Standing, where he proposes that trees and rivers and meadows and mountains can have legal rights and be represented, have standing in court. And so in 2017, the Parliament of New Zealand decided that the Whanganui River should be a legal person with rights and be represented by humans in the human legal system. And it has been followed by several others. So actually the first case concerning especially a river came from Colombia. And there has been several other cases, like, for example, the Superior Court in Bangladesh. They have decided that all the rivers in Bangladesh have legal rights as legal subjects.
So, but then, of course, the question arises, what happens if there is a conflict? Let's say you have in place this legal framework, the protection of the river or what have you, and there is suddenly a conflict of interest between different groups and so on. Who would represent the river or the entity? Because if it's decided in advance that this organization or person or whatever should represent it, there could be a problem. Because if the organization is doing something bad, if it is corrupt or whatever, then of course that will fall back negative on the river or the thing you want to protect. So In some sense, I thought like maybe anyone should be able to represent the thing you want to protect, the nature, the entity. How do you go about this kind of a challenge?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and it always arises. And I think that we are in a phase of emergence regarding rights of nature. So there are different models being tried out. So one of the first really powerful decisions was long before the Whanganui case, and that was in the constitution of Ecuador, which is another country with strong indigenous populations. And in 2008, they rewrote their constitution and they included rights of nature. And in Ecuador, they have a very liberal interpretation of representation, which is that actually anyone, as you say, anyone can be the voice of nature. And in New Zealand, they had another model where they have appointed guardians, which are the human face of the river. So one is from the Māori and one is from the state. And there was also a case, actually, just a week after the New Zealand Parliament decided on the rights of Whanganui, court in India decided that two big rivers in India, the holy rivers of Ganges and Yamuna, they should be also legal subjects. And that was later withdrawn. And one of the reasons were that this was a kind of hasty decision. The New Zealand decision was really well worked through and thought through. And the Indian decision was not. And they had state representatives. They proposed state representatives as the voices for the rivers. And those representatives, they didn't want to be that. They said, but it's really unclear. I mean, what is our responsibility if the river, for example, kills someone? Well, then what happens? So there are various models, and here in Sweden we have proposed that one way to go about would be to have an ombudsman, so a department of people tasked with being the voices of nature. And so there are a lot of technical issues around this, and to me those are secondary, because as soon as you raise the issue of saying that, well, nature has needs, rights, and interests, then you change the conversation in a profound way. And then, so how do we take care of, how do we meet those needs and interests and rights? I don't know. I mean, we can do that in various ways, but just to acknowledge that's the case is a huge step.
And if you compare, I mean, a right for a river, a legal right that you create like this, for example, comparing it to a natural reserve or, something like that, that you have, like in the US, for example, today you can just have a new president, and then a new president might say that, no, we just remove this right. So how do you make this kind of protection more permanent? Is that, I guess that's the way you write the law. It must be really solid legal framework, and kind of maybe that's the biggest kind of challenge to put in a really good framework protection that's in place. So what do you think about that kind of comparison or challenge?
I think it depends on how you think about rights of nature. And to me, this is about a societal, a cultural paradigm shift. That's what I'm working for. And law is the tool for that paradigm shift. It's not the goal. It's the tool. And so rights of nature are working in a lot of different contexts and frameworks and ways. So it's not just focusing on law. It's also focusing on, for example, I mean, people are working on this from an arts perspective, for example, from an education perspective, from various, in various ways. But one of the, what makes it powerful is, of course, that we can work through law. And that's really significant, because it's through law, it's said by the rights of nature lawyer Cormac Cullinan, for example, that law is the DNA of society. That's how we understand what's right and wrong, how we understand what's important and less important. And that's why it's really powerful to work through law. And as you say, laws can be changed. And some laws can be changed more easily. For in rights of nature, one way that it has been implemented is actually through courts. And as in the Indian case, that can be revoked quite easily also. So it's not so stable. I guess the most stable way is as in ecocide law on the international level. And that's also something that's quite difficult to achieve. So those things are in relationship with each other. But the other, the other stable way to enshrine it in law is probably through constitutions, because constitutions are not easily changed. And that is what Ecuador did. And that's also what we have proposed for Sweden, that we should include rights of nature in the constitution, where we have our rights and freedoms written down.
Yeah. So you're talking a lot of, I think the focus here should be, if I summarize a little bit, norm creation, building norms in societies, and laws is a way to do that. One of many, but mm-hmm. It is very important, because if you think about laws, it's not that you have 100 police officers waiting to just making sure that people are following it, but it creates the norms that people hesitate to do things because they know that it's sort of not acceptable socially to do things. So that, I mean, that's what norms are. People sometimes forget that it's not just written, don't do that, you'll end up in jail, because most people if they didn't care, they could do stuff and people wouldn't end up in jail anyway, because who is going to see that they are breaking the law? But the norms is very important. So, and this brings us, I think, naturally to kind of my next question, because I'm thinking about the fast development right now in the artificial intelligence field, which is both worrisome, but also could be a potentially good thing for humanity if we use it in a good way. So just recently I had a guest, Professor Olle Häggström, where we talked about AI risks. But we also talked about the potential of doing this good, doing this in a good way. But we talked about one scenario, which is quite scary, which is that the planet could turn into a paperclip planet, which is kind of crazy. But it also brings us back to what you're talking about. Humanity being the masters, trying to be the masters of nature and so on, and how crazy it could end up potentially if we don't stop this crazy development. But you are also looking into using AI tools, as I understand it, in this legal framework in a good way. And that's really interesting to hear a little bit about maybe how you go about the AI development in what you do.
Yeah. This is really mind-blowing. I don't really understand. I mean, so AI and that development isn't something that I understand a lot about, actually. And it doesn't interest me. So it scares me more than it interests me. But I was approached by a guy who has started something he called the Earth Lab within the IEEE organization, which is the largest network of engineers in the world. They organize several hundred thousand engineers. And he has been thinking about, so since this rapid development of AI is happening, can that be used to protect nature through all the information that we gather through AI? Can we protect the ecosystems better? And for me, this is a really interesting question, not least in a kind of philosophical way, because, I mean, at the moment, so we spoke about culture and cultural norms, and culture is actually kind of our operation system of humanity. That's how we decide what we do and what we don't do. And our operation system today, our culture today, is actually making the Earth into a paperclip planet. Not the paperclip planet, but I mean, as I said, we are converting living, complex, self-organizing systems into dead mechanical systems at the moment. And I think that is because we have forgotten that the Earth, that the living system is alive. We don't know that. We treat it as a resource, as objects. And we do that through law. And when we do that, when we see the world as consisting of dead objects, we are going to turn it into dead objects, paperclips or bridges or plastic or whatever. And if we can, so if we can kind of utilize AI, which is a complicated mechanical system, if we can use that complicated system to preserve the living complex systems so that it is in service to life, to me that would be really beautiful. I mean, like this saying of Einstein, what did he say? That the rational mind is a faithful servant and the intuitive mind is a sacred gift. But now we have made the servant into the master. And I think we should shift that. So we have to use the complex system that we create with our rational thinking, we have to use them in service of our intuitive minds and the living systems that is far beyond anything that we can ever fully understand. So we can just be in service of them and be try to be a part of them, trying to be in partnership and not in control. And that is a that's an existential issue, actually.
I mean, this is Elon Musk has compared it with you know, he got some question about you know, what is a super AI is comparable to a nuclear weapon, and he just looked like this and he said, like, nuclear weapon is a picnic compared to what an AI would be able to do. So that we need to understand, like, that.
Inbuilt humility, I think, which is what we totally lack. I mean, that's one of the big problems in the relationship between humans and nature, is that we totally lack humility. So we have to, I think we have to, I mean, so what is this transition or this societal transformation that we are in? What is it about? I think it's about developing that humility, that we are not in control and we can never be in control. And it's also about changing towards a situation where we understand that, I mean, where we live so that we become beneficial to the living systems, not destructive. But regenerative. And since we are so many, I mean, think about what happens when we start to really cooperate as partners to nature, to become regenerative. We can create so much beauty.
Yeah, I totally agree. This has been a quite long conversation. I don't want to make it too long for people. I could talk much more with you, but I hope to have you back on the show in the future so we can dig into this more. But for people who want to follow your work, do you have any page or site or place they can go to learn more?
I have my site, which is pellatil.se, but also andecocide.se. And if you don't speak Swedish so much, I think it's well worth looking into the stopecocide.earth site.
Yeah, and I'll provide the links below for people to get there. Thank you so much, Pellatil. I learned a lot and I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you so much, Johan. This is a great job you're doing.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Tell us what you think in the comment section below. And if you like the content and you want to support the show, we really appreciate a thumbs up and consider subscribing. In the next 3 episodes, I will talk sustainable tech with the president and founder of Tesla Club Sweden, Tibor Blomhäll, as well as the writer behind a really useful book, Owning an EV, or Skaffa Elbil in Swedish. We will share some of our lessons owning an EV and exciting news on the EV market. We will also cover Tesla's Gigafactory in Berlin and Tesla's future. So stick around, and as always, stay ahead of the curve and stay electric.